He's here now. He's on the ground. And he's not here in this room now. I just saw some people looking around. He's not here, but he's in the region. And he's covering our Bernal East. And he's a really, really nice guy. If you see him around, flag him down, say hi, get to know him. He's a really, really nice guy. He's married, and he lives here in Bernal. We have two that will be going to post. We'll get two more officers, which will probably fill us up unless somebody else decides to leave. We'll be filling our Roosevelt and Manila districts. Hopefully we'll have somebody on the ground there mid-year to the end, towards the end of the year. As you all know, we introduced Jake Greenwood the last time when we were here. He's our second newest officer, but we introduced him. I just wanted to just fill you in that just how good he is. He did a great job this year in his training and learning. He received an award at our annual Wapiti get-together. That's where all of our COs and law enforcement get together for training and discussion and meetings and get ready for the coming year. And Jake received the award that they call the Damn Good Job Award. And he deserved it. As a rookie, they don't usually get to participate in all of the things that Jake participated in. Search warrants, arrests, interrogations, and even some felony cases. So he's been extremely busy and has done an extremely good job and has represented the agency very well. And so when you see him, again, too, say hello and welcome him to the area and thank him for the great job that he's done, because he really is out there working to protect the resource and really takes it seriously. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn the time back to you.
Thanks, Wayne. Thanks for the update. We have some items on the agenda, some action items coming up. Wildlife license permits, core forms, and rule amendments.
I'm Marcia Ketty. I'm the Support Service Coordinator for the Northeastern Region. A couple of the things we'll be discussing tonight is Rule R657-45-3, Wildlife License Permits, Certificates of Registration. Last summer, RAC and Board passed a handful of fee changes that set the foundation for our proposals today. The fee changes were approved by the legislature and governor in the 2014 legislative session. The license structure we discussed today will become effective July 1st, 2014 to accompany the fees. We listened to our constituents who wanted multiple year hunting, fishing, and combination licenses. In the 2014 legislative session, we removed the valid 365 days from date of issue text from statute, which limited us to single year licenses. Statute now grants us authority to the Wildlife Board to set license terms. 365 day format adds value to purchasers and has been very popular, and we wanted to enhance it. Single year license valid for 365 days from date of purchase. We propose that allowing multiple year purchases for fishing, hunting, and combination. Adult licenses will be available for 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 years increments from date of purchase. The next thing is to allow license renewal before expiration date with no lost field days. That's one that kind of gets people, oftentimes they'll come in, say a month before their licenses are due to be repurchased, and so they'll go ahead and buy them and they'll lose. They basically double pay for that month. So this also offers a 3 and 7 day resident fishing and keep the 3 day non-resident hunting. That is the, I have three items and they are all very short. So however you guys want, if you'd like to do the questions and the voting now, or if you'd like me to go on to the next presentation.
Let's do your questions and voting at this point. So what we'll do at this point is we've had the agenda item introduced and presented. We'll take questions from the RAC. guess, is there any questions from the RAC? Sorry, I'm trying to get my mind wrapped around an agenda.
Yeah, a lot of this information you have already seen, so it's just...
You've read through the present... Yeah, I read through it. Is there any comments from the public in attendance? I've got no comment cards. Okay. Does RAC want to discuss this item? Is there any discussion?
I just want to point out the fact that I appreciate what the division's done with allowing someone that moves out of state the chance to get a non-resident permit for their remaining time. I think that's a good move.
Any other comments or questions? Okay. We need a motion and a vote.
I'll make a motion we approve rule R-657-45 as it's written.
I'll second it.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay. Motion passes.
The next one is the mentor hunting, rule R-657-67-4. This is basically just a minor housekeeping change. We had put in the existing rule that the application to participate must be made 10 business days prior to sharing the permit. We would like to remove that just to allow more flexibility, and we also felt like that we could get that accommodated, you know, in a shorter period of time so we can get the sportsman out in the field. So that's a short one, too.
So we need any discussion on that? Any questions from the board? The RAC members? No comments from the public? Okay. Any other questions or comments from the RAC? Good. I think a good thing. I heard one story today about it. And we were tickled to hear the other side of it.
Yeah.
It's a positive step for our youth.
Okay, it
keeps us old farmers out of trouble.
There you go.
Okay, we need a motion.
Move to accept the consent by the state.
I second
it. Who did the second?
Move and second.
Who did it?
Me and Mitch.
You and Mitch. Carrie and Mitch, you know.
Mister. Your Highness.
Okay, all those that vote in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Unanimous. Okay, next item.
Taking fish and crayfish, R-657-13-7. As presented and approved in our fee change proposal to the RAC and board last summer, beginning July 1st, 2014, a second pole permit will no longer be required. So we propose removing all references to it in this rule. Reminder that, you know, nothing changes with the daily bag and possession limits. So basically, if you have a combination license today and it's still valid through July, you can use your two pole. You don't have to have the two pole permit. Everybody's just grandfathered in on this, so. And that's it.
Okay, any questions from the RAC? Straightforward. Okay, do you have any comment cards? So,
I ask a question. Once you know, we've got a combination now.
Mm-hmm.
Do I have to buy it? Second pole between now and end of June?
Yes, you do.
Okay, that's what I wanted to.
Yes. That's kind of what we're explaining to people as they come into the front counter, you know. You don't have to buy it today unless you need to use it. Most people have went ahead and said, no, I want to use the two poles, so.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions or comments from the RAC? Motion.
From this side of the table?
Yeah, I was say, Rod's tried a couple of times.
I make a motion to approve the one fishing pole as proposed.
I'll second that.
I knew you were awake.
We are awake.
Okay, let's take a vote on it. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Good. I'd like to welcome John Mathis with us. We understood that you got a speeding ticket out in the parking lot.
So I just had to use the arrow.
Okay. For to the aquatic invasive species.
Trina Hedrick.
Trina.
She's the regional aquatics manager.
It's weird not having it on both. Cool, I'm flexible. For those of you that didn't hear, my name is Trina Hedrick. I'm the regional aquatics manager, and I'm just going to tell you about modifications to Rule R657-60, Aquatic Invasive Species Interdiction. It's actually very exciting what we were able to get done this year. And Sally Goffis can tell you better about the history of it and how it all got started. But there were some folks in the legislature that probably heard a little bit about Lake Powell and that finding of quagga mussel down there, maybe got a little worried, and rightly so, and added some language, changed the Utah code, so to give us authority to establish non-law enforcement inspection stations and actually make it a Class B misdemeanor if a boater does not stop at those mandatory check stations. It does a couple of things. Of course, it makes us consistent with some of our surrounding states. We do share waters with Idaho and Wyoming, so it's nice to be consistent. But more importantly, it better protects our waters and helps stop mussels before they can get to another water body. So, of course, there is a change to code, so now we have to define in-house how DWR is going to implement that change. So what they said was we're going to locate these inspection stations where there's a high likelihood of meeting up with boaters and boaters potentially carrying mussels. We're going to locate them in safe places where there is limited risk to our staff and also, of course, to the public, so nice places to turn off of a highway, that sort of thing. And that's a requirement with UDOT anyway. We are going to verify that decontamination is either started or completed. So verify that they have the paperwork for having that decontamination with a pressure rinse and a heated rinse, or that they're at least not transporting water. Make sure that they know that they have to clean, drain, and dry. And those people, we can actually put tags on their boats so that if they go into another location within that clean, drain, and dry period, which differs based on the season, but it varies from 3 days to a month. So if they're trying to launch before they're clean, drain, and dry, and they told us that they were going to clean, drain, and dry themselves, then we can know that. We'll actually have a tag on their boats, and then we can just give them a rinse before they can launch. Preparation is already underway for inspection stations, starting at Lake Powell to catch boaters leaving the lake, and then part of our funding was received to try and help protect Bear Lake. So there's a couple inspection stations being planned for Bear Lake, and you can see, maybe it's kind of hard to see, but you can kind of see we're trying to get kind of the main egress or ingress points to these waters. And that was it. So remember to clean, drain, and dry. Any questions?
So how well is the Park Service coming on board with helping out with decontamination as boats leave Lake Powell?
So you're probably aware that their funding has always been for prevention and not for containment. So they are not very well equipped to make this switch. And Richard and I don't necessarily always get the latest information. But the latest information I have is that they're moving very snooty to get this taken care of. And I don't know, Richard, do you have any more information?
That's about it. They're hopefully going to be switching over, but right now they haven't. So it's up to us to make sure that we stop the boat.
Yeah, we've been saying they're hopefully going to be switching over since last summer when the right. we first detected them. And the situation's only gotten worse. They've done surveys down at Pell going upriver, and there's pretty much everywhere they look, there was at least a couple. So, scary.
Any other questions, Mariah?
Good question. Leaving Lake Powell in as a boulder, can we expect to be stopped and decontaminated?
Yes, in the future, once these inspection stations are up and running, of course, we're always going to be limited by the manpower, personnel, funding, and that sort of thing. That's always a reality. But we are going to have those stations, once they're up and running, we're going to do the best we can to cover main hours, the people leaving. So yes, you would be required to leave if the inspection station is up and running. If it's not, then we just ask that you clean, drain, and dry. If you know you're going to want to launch sooner than that, just give us a call and we can help you out with the decontamination.
How many hours is the dry time?
So the dry time in the, Richard, help me out with this. In the summer.
7 days.
7 days, thank okay. you. And then it's about a month if it's fall or spring.
So it's 18 spring, fall, and 30 days winter, or 3 days consecutive freezing for the winter month.
And that's, when you get home, drop your motor so all that water drains out, pull the plug on live wells, even maybe open them up and let them air dry. Other tips.
Yeah, that really doesn't take effect that dry time until everything is drained, which that goes without saying, I guess.
Yeah.
But as far as your question, so just to reiterate what Trent was saying, Lake Powell will not be stopping you with their personnel and decontaminating your boat. And there's a good chance to even ask them, if you ask them to, they won't. So just give us a call, or any major water body here in Utah, or main ramp, we'll have a decontamination station there. So just make sure that you get in contact with us. You're calling us, and just meet them at the ramp with us, and we can take care of you.
Do you have one out here at Steinecker, for instance?
Yes.
Starvation, Steinecker, Flaming Gorge, and then there's the permanent station at Red Fleet that's still there. Trying to make it really easy for folks. Just give us a call.
We have two places at Flaming Gorge on the that's John's side, Cedar Springs, and then at Lucerne. And then Wyoming has a couple as well. Mm-hmm.
Another question. How many inspection stations do you figure you'd need to do a good job at decontaminating boats as they leave Lake Powell?
I haven't spent any time thinking about that. That would be Jordan and the southeastern and southern region.
Richard,
I couldn't even tell.
I don't. They would, because as you're assuming, that's a lot of people coming out of there, so I don't know how many decon stations that they need to have. I couldn't tell you. I know that Jordan is talking about putting up permanent stations like Red Fleet, but a little bit bigger at some of these pinch points, just to accommodate that. So,
any other questions from the board? Comments? Do I have a motion?
I'm looking at the right side of the table.
And I'll make the motion that we accept this proposal as presented.
I'll second it.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Okay, thank you. Justin Shannon, the big game coordinator, will give us our goals.
Yeah.
My name is Justin Shannon. Tonight I'm going to give the Bucks Bulls once in a lifetime permit recommendation. Recommendations for 2014. So to begin, we'll start with mule deer. Wanted to give a quick background on where we've been over the last 10 years in regards to our general season buck harvest and where we are today. As you can see on the x-axis, you have the number of years, and on the y, the number of deer harvested in the thousands. These are bucks. And we've gone from about 19,000 deer harvested in some of those bad years all the way up to 28,000. In the last 2 years, things have been on an upward.
Whoa, sorry. Oops. Broken arrow.
At least my phone's not ringing. But the last 2 years, we've harvested over 25,000 bucks on our general season units, which has been really good. Fawn production over the last 15 years, you can see we've had our peaks and our valleys, especially late 90s, early 2000s. Last 5 years or so, we've been between 61 and 65 fawns per 100 does. And then for buck to doe ratios over that same time period, the last 15 years, for a long time we were hugging right around 15 bucks per 100 does, a little over, a little under. And then it peaked in about 2007 and 18 bucks per 100 does. And the last 2 years have been really good. Last year we were 18 bucks per 100 does, and this year we were at 19 bucks per 100 does on general season units. So things are looking up. With that background, I'd like to get into the general season deer permit recommendations. Statewide, we're recommending an increase from 84,600 permits to 84,800. But because we have these 30 units, it's not just a straight 200 increase. We're actually recommending decreases on 6 of these units, no changes on 17, and then increases on 7 of them. There's a lot on this table, so I think I'll take a minute and explain it. On the far left, you have the 30 units, and this will be several slides in a row. And then the second column there, you have the objective, whether we're managing for 15 to 17 bucks per 100 doe or 18 to 20 in this case here. And then our 3-year average, which is what we manage to. So if our 3-year average is above the objective, we increase permits, and if it's below, we decrease. And then finally, we have a buck to doe ratio trend. It's not a true trend, but I just wanted to present an indication of where we are this year relative to last year in our buck to doe ratios. And then on the far right, what we're recommending for this next year. So in 2014, we're recommending decreases on the Beaver and the North Slope units, and a slight increase on the Pine Valley unit. Next slide, we're recommending decreases on the Box Elder and the Cache units there in yellow, and increases on the Zion and the Southwest Desert units. And then finally, we're recommending decreases on South Slope Bonanza Vernal and the West Desert West, but we're recommending increases on the Monroe, Oker Stansberries, Anguish Lake, and the Wasatch Mountains West. Moving on to premium limited entry deer, I wanted to take a minute and explain how these permits are generated and the sideboards that we follow when it comes to these unique units, the Henry Mountains and the Ponsagon. What we're managing for down there on normal permits is for 40 to 55% of the bucks harvested to be 5 years or older. And so on the Henry Mountains, you can see our 3-year average, we're well above that range. 72% of our bucks harvested are 5 years or older. And on the Ponsagon, 64% are. The management buck hunts are a little different though. Those are managed, or those are predicated on a buck to doe ratio. These same units we manage for 40 to 50 bucks per 100 does, and so if we're above that, we increase, and if we're below, we cut permits. So on the Henry Mountains, we're at 50, our buck-to-doe ratio over the 3 years is 56, And on the Pontagon, it's 44, with a declining trend going from 47, 44 to 40. So with that background, this year on the Hanrys, we're recommending an increase in 3 permits from 48 to 51 for the normal premium limited entry hunt. And on the Pontagon, an increase of 9 from 135 to 144. For management buck permits, it's a little different. Take a look at the second table down on the Henry Mountains. We're recommending an increase of 5 from 30 to 35 permits. And on the Pontagon, we're recommending a decrease of 8. Again, just because we don't like the trend of that buck to doe ratio, and it's right in the middle. So for the other limited entry units, we manage these at 25 to 35 bucks per 100 does. 3-year averages are there on the far right. And as you can see on the Fillmore Oak Creek, Dolores Triangle, and West Desert Vernon, we're below where we need to be, and on the South Slope, Diamond Mountain, we're a little bit above. So with that background, this is the recommendations for limited entry hunts. Probably 2 things from this slide I'd want to draw your attention to. The first is the West Desert Vernon, where we're recommending a decrease in about 15 permits. And statewide, that's essentially where these cuts are coming from 827 to 811 permits. And the other would be the book cliffs. If you remember when we met in November, we talked about splitting the north and the south to kind of distribute hunters and deal with some of the discrepancies in the buck to doe ratios. So on the north, for the any weapon hunt, we're recommending 190 permits, and on the south, 66. Oftentimes we get asked, how does this break down with archery, any weapon, and muzzleloader? And as you can see with the decrease in permits, the bulk of that is occurring in the any weapon portion. Moving on to elk, for general season, the statewide plan calls for spike permits to remain at 15,000 if the hunter success rate is below 20%. And this year we were right at 17%. Thus, we're not recommending any changes to the 15,000 spike elk permits. Additionally, we're recommending no changes to the general any bull permits, the 14,300 and the 300 youth any bull and the 20 late youth any bull. No changes for general season. For limited entry, it's a little bit different. We're recommending an increase of 100 total permits statewide, or 3.6% from 2,742 to 2,842. And with elk, we don't manage to a buck to doe ratio or anything like that. The bulls that are harvested, we manage to an age class objective. And so the first set of hunts here, we manage for 7.5 to 8-year-old bulls. And as you can see there in the middle column, the 3-year average age is, for most of these, are below the 7.5 to 8-year-old sideboards. And so with that, we're recommending decreases in permits on the Beaver East, Book Cliffs Little Creek, Fillmore Pavant, the Monroe, and the San Juan unit. And then the Plateau Boulder Caparoids would stay the same as last year. And this is kind of a common trend for us in the 7.5 to 8-year-old unit. I was looking at 2011, and we had well over 400 permits, and so these are units that we've cut into quite drastically over the last couple of years to try to get those ages where they need to be. For 6.5 to 7-year-old units, they kind of all over the place with this. We have a couple of units where we're below, and we recommend cuts on the Nebo and the Diamond Mountain, and then the Southwest Desert Indian Peaks, recommending an increase of 8 permits there. And same thing for the Book Cliffs Bitter Creek, but overall a difference of 2 permits for this age category. For the 5.5 to 6-year-old units, this is where the bulk of our units and our elk are in the state. We're recommending an increase of 99 permits, or a 5.9% increase. And with no exceptions, all these units are at or above objective, so we're recommending increases on the Manti, the LaSalle's, Three Corners, 9 Mile Anthro, Plateau Fish Lake, and the Wasatch Mountains. And then finally, for 4.5 to 5-year-old units, again, they're all doing really well. They're above their age objectives, and recommended increases on all of them except for the North Cache there, which is slightly below, and a decrease of 17 permits. I thought this presentation was going really well until Dax called me today and said that Randy spotted some mares in our table, which I'm grateful for, because I'd rather Thank you, Randy. I'd rather find them now than after I've gone to the Wildlife Board. And what happened was, these are some errors on my part, that all the permits that I showed you are as is, but when I put them in the table, we had some that were a little bit high and some that were a little bit low, because of some of the formula stuff I had in the spreadsheets. And so these have all been corrected now to reflect the permits that I just showed you. All these permits and these age objectives are correct. I just had to update the individual tables.
So the Boulder Plateau, it is remaining the same tags as last year?
Yeah, a good example would be, on the big table here on the plateau, we recommended 82 permits, but then in the tables it actually was closer to 87, if I remember right. And so I had to do some tweaking, and yeah, I'm embarrassed, but thank you, Randy. I appreciate it. So. Moving on to pronghorn, let's see, statewide recommending a decrease in 60 permits from 841 to 781, and the bulk of these are cuts on the plateau, or the Parker Mountains, essentially. For once-in-a-lifetime permits, start with moose, recommend a decrease of 4 permits from 71 to 67. For bison, from 104 to 84. Desert bighorn sheep, recommend a slight increase from 37 to 40. Decrease on Rocky Mountain bighorns, and then finally, a decrease in mountain goats from 162 to 108. And that's all I have for the bucks, bulls, once-in-a-lifetime. I know it says the antlerless and bucks, bulls is all one agenda item, but it may be wise to discuss this first, and then we'll get into antlerless, if that's okay.
Questions, comments from the back?
I have a question. This, so on the once-in-a-lifetime permit, were those, so many of those species, the permits have dropped, is that because their numbers have dropped?
In some cases, yeah. And some of that's by design. So if you look at mountain goats, for instance, we got really aggressive with our nanny hunts last year with our translocations. And so if you continually stay aggressive, you're gonna dip into it more than we want to. Other than that though, just minor housekeeping with the ones coming through.
Just, I got one question on the limited entry deer. Uh-huh. On the going back to the Ponsagon, it looks to me like we're going to have an increase of nine tags with the archery, the any weapons, or the muzzle loader, but a decrease of eight tags with the management buck. Is that
correct?
Is that correct?
Yeah, and
overall, it's just a one tag increase overall.
Yeah. I guess if you wanted to look at it that way, yeah, it would be just a change of one. Our management plan is interesting because we manage the buck to doe ratio with those management plans exclusively. That's kind of its own category. And then what we do with the normal permit, the premium permit that we would have there, that's just all driven on the age objective. And there's kind of two separate ways to look at managing that bird. So.
Any questions from the board?
I have a question.
Ron.
Yeah, on the Bookcliffs population objective here, is that number the rolled part and the rolledless together?
Are you talking for elk?
Yeah, on the elk.
What's the objective?
It is 75. 70, yeah. So that's bold.
Yep.
Okay.
Model them together.
From what my calculations here from the chart that I have, we're 2,700 animals low of our objective on there. I would like to see, if they're counting these elk together, I would like to ask the RAC and the Wildlife Board to please consider putting these areas the same age objective. I would like to see, I've got a problem, I sold my horse. That is a problem. So my cat go into the roadless areas, too far to walk, and I would love to see some trophy bulls in this road part area. And from the age objective, I can see we're almost there. I would like to see those included and added as the same older age objective so that we can enjoy a closer area a little bit closer and a little more accessible to get to. And then I have one more question. Is the spike cut necessary where we're so far on the Bookcliff road part area, where we're so far below objective?
Is it, I mean, is it necessary? Depends on how you define necessary. I mean, the purpose of this bike hunt is to be able to provide opportunity for guys to hunt these animals and go learn new areas and different things like that. And we are under objective on the booklets. But with that, when you kill spikes, you're not affecting population growth, because population growth is driven by the production of young and the survival rates of those young and the adult females. And so it really is recreational driven. It's not like you're hurting production or anything along those lines because you're harvesting those spikes. So I guess that's probably the best way I know how to answer that.
Does this sound like a good idea to you to add both booklet carries the same age objective, where they're side by side, their elk numbers are counted together here?
You know what we need to do with that is the statewide elk plan will be put together next year, I think is the schedule that we have it for. And we have a lot of units in the state like that. So we hear the same thing in southern Utah, where they're managing for a 7.5 to 8 year old bull right next to a 5.5 to 6 year old bull. And they're the same elk because they migrate to and from. So I think when that plan comes up, we've got to take a hard look at a lot of these areas and try to figure out what makes sense to have top echelon quality units lumped together and then more opportunity and mid-quality lumped together as well. I'm open to it, I guess.
I did notice in there also that there are a few antlers given in the book cliffs, and I really think that is necessary. I think the ranchers out there have got to be protected.
Yeah.
You know, I realize we need those cows there to get their population objective higher, but I think those ranchers need to be protected also. I'm against a big, large number, but a small number like you guys have, I think is a very good idea.
And we'll get to the analyst PowerPoint next, but some of those hunts, it's not a lot of permits, and it's more to keep pressure, so elk don't feel comfortable in some of these areas that they should be. It's not always about the harvest. You just train elk and treat my soul.
Shannon, when you look at the plan objectives, as far as statewide, the division is doing an excellent job of getting the numbers there. And when you look at them, there's most of them are above average. There's a few, there's within 50, and two within 100. But when you look at the book cliffs, that's 2,700. I mean, the lowest one is 500, but then there's one at 500 and two at 250, and the rest of them are all below that. What, other than kill cats, which I think we're doing a little bit more of now, what do we do to bring those numbers up in the book list?
Yeah, I think it's a lot like with any of our ranges where, you know, Utah's, more so than any other western state, we are all in on habitat projects. And so we've shown that on a lot of our deer and elk ranges to manipulate and treat areas in order to get revegetative growth that would help deer and elk and livestock and everything. And so that's one of the things that we've been very aggressive with. And the book cliffs is unique because really what that range is lacking is 2,000 feet in the world. It's summer range limited and some of this stuff. And so I think we'll keep trying those efforts and hopefully we get some growth there. But unless Dax, do you have a better way to answer that?
Maybe you guys remember a couple rack meetings ago. Our habitat biologist came and showed some slides of some of the habitat work that's taking place in this region. And the book cliffs, it's our largest unit, but it's also the unit where we've done the most work. And I mean, if you drive out there, you know, drive down Seabridge Road, you can see all those full hog treatments and, you know, and they're doing a bunch of chainings. I think what Justin said, I mean, that it's not because we're harvesting a lot of cows. That population just typically has a lower calf to cow ratio. It just doesn't have as high a production. If we had a couple more thousand feet in elevation, or if somebody could pull some strings and get it to rain out there a little more often, I think we could grow more elk faster. But we're being pretty aggressive, spending a lot of money doing a lot of habitat improvement and a lot of water development, a lot of guzzlers and spring development and spring maintenance and pond maintenance. And you know, we got guys like Mr. Brewer here who holds us to the fire and keeps us busy with keeping the water development going out there. I mean, we're doing the work, and I think if conditions, there's a few factors that are outside of our control, but I do think we're growing elk, but maybe not as fast as some of us would like to see.
Any other questions from the board? All right. Sir, John,
if we're that far under objective, I mean, we're doing all of this. We are spending a significant amount of money we're putting into habitat, right? And is the objective realistic? Or does the objective need to be reevaluated in that case? Because we do have all those factors play a role. And you look at the charge, you look at the objective, and you think, wow, this is quite wrong. But you look at the money you're putting into it, and the effort that's going into it, and what the results are.
I think that's a really fair question. And the thing is, if we were just doing it for elk, if we were only doing these habitat treatments for elk, maybe that's a really good discussion. But I mean, these treatments benefit deer, they benefit the bison, they benefit a lot of these things. And so, and I know on this, I came from the southeast region when they had that fire years ago. The biologist, Brad Crompton, he noted a really positive influence on the elk as a result of that. They use those areas that were burned. The elk seem to be doing better in those areas, and so that's why I think that habitat treatments can have an effect. And I think it's a conversation worth having.
Are you talking about reducing the effort on habitat?
Yeah.
I understand the benefit.
Yeah.
One of the primary benefits is the watershed, which is really tough out there. There just isn't that much.
John has a really good point, and probably would make it we should take a look at it when we review those plans coming up. And 15 years ago, when we 15, maybe even a little more now, time goes by so fast. When we set that objective, it was set high, and so you know that's something that we should probably take a look at. When we address that plan next year, did you say?
Yeah, the statewide plan would be next year, and so the unit plan would probably be the following year.
And the booklist is scheduled to be flown to do so. We missed a year out there because of the way the flights work. So I'm kind of excited to get another survey flight out there and see, because I do think we've grown some elk, and it'll be nice to kind of truth the models and get a flight in there and see how it looks.
Another thing that we've done on some of our units is we leave the 7,000 objective as a long-term objective, and then we rein it in and have a short-term objective, and so we can actually measure are we progressing and can we actually get there. So all good things to consider when this comes up.
The habitat effort that's happening.
We got good personnel working on it.
And good partners too. I mean,
you have a lot of money from that.
Yeah.
Did I hear the comment that there's kind of a high mortality rate in the calves out in that area?
On the book list?
Book list.
I think it's just low production is what it is. When we do the classification, that's generally in the 40 calves per 100 cows. Is that about right?
And yeah, or even lower. Yeah.
The rest of the state we're averaging about 50, and so. It's just going to take longer to grow, I guess, is what I'm saying.
My next question is, if that's the case, how can you justify killing the young spike bull?
Just because the spike bull hunt is more of a recreational thing. When you're talking, I know it sounds counterintuitive.
It's got to do with the water breed, management.
I grew up on a ranch, and so we had a lot of cows. But we didn't carry a lot of bulls just because they didn't contribute a whole lot to the population. And so what we would do is we would carry very low bull-to-cow ratios on our own private herds just because they're not contributing. And so whether they're harvested or not, then it doesn't matter population growth-wise. And if anything else, if you remove a bunch of those spikes and all the cows are getting bred, you're actually, if you really have elk competing for resources out there, you're actually minimizing those males, and so you're leaving more range and resources for the females to throw more calves and to really get better growth. It sounds counterintuitive that you can kill males and it won't affect population growth, but it's a real thing.
What is your crew look like?
What do you think? I don't know. It's not an area that we've really put a bunch of radio collars on and stuff like that.
Because I mean, even if you're having 40 for every 100, and you've got a recruitment, you know, an exponential recruitment, you still might have population growth versus a different unit that's got a high drop rate versus a low recruitment rate.
Yeah, and maybe I mean, Dex said it, we're growing, but we're probably just not growing like we do everywhere else in the state. So I think it's just a slower process because of some of the challenges that we've talked about.
We have seen a lot of elk move throughout that region too, that we do have collars on. We had a cow come all the way from the Anthro onto the book lifts and back. And so, you know, if you start thinking about even that south side of the desert, Colorado, the roadless on the tribe, and I mean, there's a lot of country there, and I think a lot more movement than we might be aware of.
One more question on the spike hunt. Is the spike hunt in the limited entry still open to where if a guy draws a permit, he can go to the book cliffs or one of the other units?
Yes.
So you've really not, it doesn't, wouldn't happen, but in effect, everybody that draws a permit could go to one area, like the book cliffs.
That's one
they
way.
Got to, they sure. could go to the book cliffs, everybody could draw one.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They buy them over the counter, you don't draw the spike tag.
So there's no set amount as far as trying to manage who can go in there and kill spikes. It's just open.
Yeah, because a lot of times it's self-limiting in the sense that hunter crowding and different things like that. When we put these permits out there and we've looked at it, hunters do distribute themselves pretty well across the landscape. But another way that I would propose we look at it is if we start closing a bunch of these areas, then what you're talking about is much more likely where we're putting 15,000 spike elk hunters in giving them fewer options, and so we're actually adding to the crowding and hunter pressure on these other units that remain open. And so in a lot of ways, if you leave it open, you can spread the hunters out more and it's less of an impact. Just another way of looking at it. So.
Just to kind of follow up with what Rich is talking about spike elk, what is the success rate on the hunt out there in the book list for spikes? Is it pretty low?
22 to 26% last year.
It's one of the higher success rates. Mid 20s last year.
Higher relative.
It's relative to the other spike units. It's one of the higher success rates spike hunts.
Sorry, did you have a question as well?
You have questions or comments?
I guess if we want to propose anything as a group for the spike hunt, it's really not at this meeting. It's at another meeting. Is that right? That's probably the November meeting.
Right. When I come back in November and we talk about which units we can have season dates and have open and close and things like that, that would be the time, because right now we've already presented it in our application guidebooks and things like that. That you can have the book closed. So if we closed it, it would be a lot of work to inform all the hunters that felt like they could go hunt it based on what was passed last November, December.
Okay. So. And to Rod's question there on the age objective there in the book list, we really can't do anything with that tonight. Is that right? Because we really need to, that's part of the annual end of the 5-year plan for the for the elk management?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to recommend that we look at it and things like that, I mean, the RAC can do what it would like, but really the time to have that conversation would be in, again, the November one, because that way when we set it up, we can inform hunters that if you're going to put in for the book cliffs, then it's going to be a lower or a higher age objective. And so it's probably more of a fairness issue to the hunters that are putting in. So, I would say do it in November if we're going to do it. Did that make sense? Maybe I didn't say that very well.
What do we have this plan? 2 years now?
No, the elk plan?
Yeah.
We're almost done with it.
That's about done.
We revisit it next year. So next summer we'll put a statewide committee together and have a hard look at this elk plan.
I noticed the Buckliff Roadless and the Bitter Creek has the same 3-year average of 7.0, as the age average. So right now they're right there together. To me it does kind of make sense to.
Yeah.
To make that make them the same. It's not like you gotta.
Me too.
Because
if they're the same now, it's really odd to be cutting permits on one donut hole and then increasing them on the outside. So yeah, I think it's a really good conversation to have when we look at the plan.
Okay, there was a couple of emails sent to me. I'll turn these over to BWR anyway. Written to the RAC members, many of you got them in your email. This is on the Zion Unit Desert sheep tags. There's an increase from 8 to 12 hunting permits. There was a concern from both email parties here about limited area, increased tags. I guess as I grew up down in that area, they do have a grave concern there because there is limited hunt area around Zion National Park. And we've got sheep in that area and it's kind of limited area. And I'll turn this over to you.
Thank you.
But, anything else from the rack? Bucks, bulls, antlers. Questions from the audience?
J.C. Bureau Connect addressed Mitch Hacking's concern about those spike bull hunt.
Come to mind. You bring it to you.
Open my big mouth, didn't I? Mitch, if you had a pasture that had a hunt, would carry 100 head of cattle, how many bulls would you run?
Yeah, see, that's a different program. No, I sell cattle.
It's not.
It is. You don't manage wildlife like you do livestock.
We're not
asking on any day of the week. You don't manage
an unusual large amount of males is counterproductive to your production because the males that are not, if you have too many males, you're wasting your resource. DWR has tried to address that by allowing some of us guys that like shoot spikes to give us another opportunity for another hunt. I'm here tonight, I'm not here tonight to do it, but I'm going to defend DWR's spike program simply because every time they kill a spike up there, they don't hurt the bull count any, and they save some resource for the animals that are producing young cows. Also, I have always maintained, and will again today, that part of the problem with our deer herd in the Bluegrass, which is further below objective than our elk herd is competition with elk. Predators, drought, and elk. Out of the deer meeting last spring was the top three items that they gave for the problem with our deer herd. So if we can reduce the non-productive elk out there, need a little more feed, a little more space, a little more water, specifically water. Here I am, broken record again, but specifically water. We're doing ourselves a favor by killing a few of those spikes. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. If I can rebuttal. and I agree, but I guess the issues I got is you manage it, you got an elk herd, you manage it for the resource. You got your objective and your resources. And if you got a drought, you've got to keep them animals down, and I agree, so that they've got feed. You get through your winter and your spring ranges. You use hunting, you use recreation and hunting to help manage them. And you can do your resources and everything else. I guess where I got the problem is where on the spike hunt, if management is down on the bulls, what's the total population? Say on Diamond, we have cows. So we can keep our objective. We work our objective that way. I have a hard problem with anybody that draws a permit can go anywhere they want. If they would, my big hang up when they did this was the fact they didn't say, all right, we're going to manage this area. We'll take so many spike out of it because this certain numbers are certain objective. I mean, right now, everybody that gets a permit can go to Bookless. They want to. And kill, you know, to me, there's no management. It's opportunity, heck of opportunity. And that's the problem I got. I agree with what you're saying. I just have a hard time the way they're using the spike hunt to do it. And we had that issue. That's why we banned it and we didn't want it on Diamond Mountain. We didn't feel it was a good management tool for Diamond Mountain. So I'm not really disagreeing with you. The mix. And to me, I'm just having a hard time following it. You know, to me, there would be a set amount of spike brought out of the bookers as part of the management plan. Not just, I mean, anybody that draws a permit can be down there for more. How do you keep track of it? Well, we hear the hunters disperse themselves. Well, maybe they do. No, I don't know. I'm just not bought into it yet. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Any other comments from the audience?
I'll give you one. Just a historical thing, J.C. I recall I was in the meeting when Karpowitz first brought that up, I'm playing years ago. He said, you've got too many males running around on the mountains. Let's take some of them out and make them income producing as well as opportunity producing activity. And I was on the board when we voted for that. It first started down in Monroe, and they voted for it. There were just a couple of units in the state where they had to spike out things. They said it looked good, so I voted for it. Looking back, I wouldn't vote for that unless it was so many on each unit, just like what you're saying, Rich. I agree with that. I think it should be. Each unit, when they have a proportional share of that 15 down, I'm not opposed to you going down to 12. Because you've got some units, especially your 7.5 to 8, they're all under age objective except for one, as I recall. Look at that screw. And Karpowitz says, we need to kill some of those males, and there's some validity to that. But I think also we could help our age objective if we had a few more males running around there. But what JC say is the same thing. You know, we're saving some of the food for the herd producing animals. If there's anything, and Chad and I respect everything you said. So I'm not saying, because if anything, just on this new elk plan, somebody needs to address that. That's all I'm saying, is that we need to address that. We'll spike bulls and parlay them across the state by you. And there might be some units you don't want it down the line. I remember when we held them down in Mount Hoffman.
Thanks, Dale.
Can I ask one more question? On this book list we're talking about, as far as the pregnancy rates, do we see a real fluctuation on the real dry years where we don't have as much feed, we don't have as much water out there, as far as if we're only having 40 to 50% pregnancy rate, do we see much of a swing there, or is it just pretty well constant? Because if it's constant, I'm thinking we don't have enough bulls out there.
Maybe if we had a wet enough year compared to...
You compare some well.
Maybe if we had something, maybe we had that upswing, but
I guess I'm not too worried that we don't have enough bulls to breed the cows. I don't think that's an issue out there. There's a lot of bulls running around. I think it's more a factor of nutrition and body condition, and there might be some predation. That summer range is such a narrow band there in the Book Cliffs, and that's where all the bears are in the spring too. I mean, there's a lot of issues that we don't know. I don't definitely know the answer to you, but I do feel pretty confident that we have adequate, you know, bulls to breed those cows. I think the production's not related to a lack of bulls. It's related to other factors.
Okay.
But that's my opinion. I don't have hard data to back that up. That's my opinion.
The element of the big elephant in the room, and this whole thing, and Mr. Karpowitz proposed that, he said the money, the way DWR is financed, largely by tags and by hunting fees, lends itself to that type of management. And I don't see that's going to change in the state significantly, because we've tried to wean them off general fund and make them pay. I don't remember the exact number, but it's well over 80% of the money comes from money fees and licenses. And part of that is that we want to provide hunting opportunities for a wide variety of people, because we're seeing a decline in hunting interest. And so the spike bull hunt is really important to get a lot of people out in the field. Get a little excitement, but to leave it open and allow them to all come into one area can be damaging too. So especially if we're in an area like the Blood Cliffs where we have limited resource of water. And how many new guzzlers are we putting in each year in the Blood Cliffs? Do you know that? Are we got a significant effort in spreading this out for production, and is that continuing into the future?
It is. Yeah.
Because part of the problem is you got that narrow summer band and you got limited water on that band. And so you're congregating everything, and you're congregating the bears, and you're congregating the cows, and everything under those. And if you can spread that out with water, like we do with the rest of the county, your reproduction goes up. Body condition goes up. Cat survivability goes up. But I'd sure like to look at limiting the number of spots.
Can I speak to that for 1 second?
Yeah.
I know the potential exists for all 15,000 hunters to go there, but I think we've had the Book Cliffs open to spike bull hunting for 4 or 5 years now. And my question would be, if all 15,000 hunters could have done that already, why didn't they do it already? I mean, when I say that these hunters spread themselves out, it's not because I'm projecting that's what they do. It's by looking backwards and saying, okay, units like the Manti and the Wasatch that have the most elk, they also have the most spike hunters. And then smaller units like even the San Juan, you know, it's a smaller unit, 1,300 elk on it. But we kill 24 spikes a year on that thing. And so it really is proportionate. And so I know the fear is there and the potential exists. But I guess I would say before we start talking about limiting it, it already is limited relative to some of these other units in the state. So that's just my take on it.
Can I ask a question?
Josh?
To answer that, didn't Dax and Clint say that the success rate in the Book Cliffs on spike bull elk was over 20%? Did you guys say that?
20, which kind of hunt you want.
Yeah, and then on the screen, you guys said if the success rate was over 20%, you would knock down the spike bull elk tags. So the Book Cliffs is taking a hit where other units aren't. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, on a percentage wise, yeah. But if you have, I guess my take is if you only have 100 guys there and they kill 23 spikes, is that really detrimental? And it is 23% of the hunters. But I guess I'm looking at it where we've looked at these units statewide, the units that have the most elk garner the most spike elk hunters. And units that have lower populations, they don't bring a lot of spike hunters in. And so the percentage rate could be there. That's why we look at it statewide, because we know on 15,000 elk this last year we killed about 2,500 statewide, which isn't a huge deal for the entire state. But we're not seeing people congregated on these smaller units. And we have data to show that. I'm good looking backwards. So.
Okay.
One more question.
just go back on experience. We had a draw that was pretty much open. It was during the general season. And anybody who would come up and say, we would let hunt. And there were people would go in there, they'd be walking over each other before daylight, this, you know that. The success rate was really low. We found out that if we would limit the amount of people and figure out how many we wanted to kill, and only let that many people go in, we got the kill we wanted, and they had a good hunt. It wasn't a big mess. Well, I'm not saying that bad down there, but are you getting a lot of hunters in there, and they're only getting 20% because there's so many hunters coming in on top of each other?
Yeah, I guess when it comes to spike hunting, 20% is really good. Just because it's such a difficult hunt to go on. It really is. And I've hunted spikes for years in Utah, and I've never killed one. And I've tried and tried and tried, and it is really, really tough. And maybe I've just lost all my street credibility. but I guess what I'm saying is it truly is harder than it's not.
I'll tell you, I like hunting spikes in the Book Cliffs, not because I necessarily like hunting spikes, but because it's so much less crowded than hunting any bull on the South Slope. It can't get away from people on the South Slope, so I like going to the Book Cliffs. You can actually
walk a little bit and get away from people out there. It's less crowded than the south slope.
Yeah, that spike muzzleloader hunt out there, I mean, there's...
You got it to yourself.
You get maybe 50, you know, in a weekend. It's a really low number.
I don't
see, when you get to that point, when you've got it open, you can reduce the number that may be there. And, you know, rather than if you have to draw for a permit, you're forcing 500 or 600 people there, depending on what you got. You're forcing them there.
Yeah.
So there's an issue of doing it limited entry.
Any further questions from the rack? Do we hear a motion?
Are we going to do this in two pieces?
We got the animals. You want to hear the animals first and then vote on both?
Yeah.
Is that your question or comment period?
Sorry, that was probably my fault. I got scared of it.
Well, we didn't have any comment
cards. I didn't have your comment card right there. I asked for them early.
Okay.
All right, Troy Justice, Sportsman Fishing Wildlife. Just one thing, as you brought up on that Zion thing with the concerns that come over the internet there with the emails. Very familiar with the Zion unit. I hunt it every year. It's one of your largest desert sheep populations. You're not limited on area, you're limited on access. And you have a built-in nursery with Zion there, and it would be a shame to limit that opportunity since we have those animals there. I think the thing that we need to look at versus trying to keep permit numbers low is maybe adopting a split season similar to what we've done on the Range Creek side, because currently, I believe the season down there is almost 60 days. And so if we split it and give, you know, guys, you know, 25 days, whatever, then you can avoid some of that crowding issue. It's just limited access points is all it is. Trophy quality is still there. You got a high number of sheep. I think we need to provide that opportunity for those people that want to hunt desert sheep. As far as, you know, concerning the division's recommendations, we support the division's recommendations except for three. This year, the statewide deer plan comes up, and the committee convenes here in a couple of weeks, and we'd ask that the RAC support the Southern RAC in their recommendation to leave the trophy tags on the Ponsagon and the Henrys the same as 2013 until this deer committee can convene and discuss some of the issues they have with maintaining trophy quality on there. We'd go ahead and support what the move in the management tags, but we'd ask that the trophy tags stay at the numbers they were last year. And we'd also ask the RAC to support the Southeastern and voted last night to adopt the 2013 numbers on the Central Manti Elk Permits Trophy Tax. Thank you.
Any other comments? No comment cards from the board. Okay. Motion from the board. Any other questions from the board before the motion? No questions?
I got a question. So going back to your what you said, the Southwest region did, the Southern region, the Ponsagon tags that where the division is recommending increasing 8, they didn't adopt that increase
on the trophy. No, they wanted the trophy
just sales. On the premium tags.
Correct.
They left it where it was, but they thought the reduction of
man.
I guess it was the division is recommending 9 increases. And a decrease of 8 on the management box. So they recommend leaving it treated that like it was.
Yeah, it's one of the same trophy tags as last year.
Discussion by the RAC.
I'd like these folks make a motion to support Sportsman for Wildlife. See how it's supposed to go. That's my comment.
Make a motion.
I'll make a motion then that we amend the DWR proposal with the proposals presented by Troy and the Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife. Do you want to repeat what they were?
What were they? Go with last year's numbers?
What do you propose on both options?
Adopted division's recommendations with three stipulations or changes. that the Ponsagunt trophy tags stay the same as 2013 numbers. The Henry trophy tag.
Slower.
Okay.
Ponsagunt. Thank you.
I'm afraid I'll start like talking in church. I get too many microphones. Exactly. Now, we recommend that the trophy permits on the Ponsagunt stay the same as 2013, and the trophy tags on the Henry stay the same as 2013. And also the trophy bull tags on the Central Mountains Manti stay the same as 2013.
Which, I'm sorry, which Manti?
Central.
That's southeast.
The Southern Rack voted to accept that recommendation on the Ponsagunt and the Henry, and the Southeastern voted to accept that recommendation on the Manti.
But you're not recommending that we do a split season on the Zion?
We can't address that now. That's something that's going to have to come in the future. I think that's something we look at for next year, because it's set for this year, but I think that would eliminate the problem with the crowding issues.
And this is just based on the reconvenience of the DARE permit committee, their committee having not met yet. Is that the parameters for this? Because I don't understand why this is being proposed at this point.
Well, there's some concern with maintaining trophy quality, and so what they want to do is have those different ideas discussed at the DARE committee. And so rather than make a change and have to go back down future, just leave it status quo until that committee was able to go through and discuss the plan and see exactly how they're going to manage those units, because there is some talk of change in that.
So the motion is to amend the DWR proposal with the proposal presented by Sportsman for Fish and Wildlife to adopt the division's recommendation with three changes. Ponsagunt trophy tags stay the same as 2013. Trophy tags on Henry stay the same as 2013. Central Manti stay the same as 2013.
Yes, ma'am.
But the Ponsagunt was with the exception of the management box, you recommended that they keep that.
Yeah, we're just strictly talking trophy.
Just muzzle loader or any weapon or
trophy. Now, what about the Manti? The Manti was bowls. These are the bowls. Trophy bowls.
I second the motion.
Who is this?
Rod.
Yes.
Are you asking?
Do you have a second? Yeah. I have a second. Rod's second. Discussion on.
Well, I just want to see the actual the numbers.
Yeah,
I want to go back to the slides. Well. The rationale for the increase.
Okay. So this slide here.
Yeah. Maybe you scroll that.
Okay. The rationale for the increase was for the trophy tags, the ones that Troy's referring to, on the Henry Mountains we manage for and the Ponsagunt we manage 40 to 55% of the bucks to be 5 years or older. And on the Henry Mountains, 72% of the bucks are 5 years or older, and on the Ponsagunt, 64% or over. And so that's why the division came with the recommendation here to increase on both of those. So that was the justification behind the division.
Three tag increase on the Henrys, and then so the Ponsagunt is nine tag increase. I would like to make a comment that all the proposals made are based on stipulations and regulations that we have set forth prior to. If we had a crystal ball, we'd all be in really great shape. And we don't know what the DARE committees are going to convene and say, but at this point, managing on what we know historically from current data, it suggests that we should have an increase in tags. Now, whether or not that's going to impact or change trophy class on the Ponsagunt or the Henrys, it'd be really great if we all knew, or if the DARE committee was going to have some magical solution to that. But as it stands, given the data that we have collected, we're above objective on both of those units. And I don't see a reason to make a stand on those tags, given the data that we have.
I'd like to make a comment that, I agree with Carrie that these objective numbers are pretty good, but sometimes they're not everything. Sometimes you got to look at other variables when you look at this stuff. And so that's why I kind of lean towards going Sportsman for Wildlife. That's why I'm doing it that way.
Mr. Hackett.
Yes, ma'am.
although I understand where we're coming from on this, and I 100% respect the idea and notion that we should discuss before we make any changes. However, this is discussion that was had prior to making recommendations and beginning a plan. I think if we're going to walk, you know, cautiously every single step we make, even though these steps are already planned out, we're going to be constantly second-guessing ourselves. This is a decision that was made prior to tonight. This is a decision that was made prior to any group committee meeting over next year's numbers and the year after that and the year after that. The data we have says that if we're over objective, we get to increase opportunity. We get to increase tag numbers as it stands.
I just make a comment that the, one of the purposes of the RAC committee is to look at these agendas and make decisions on our what we've learned, what we listened to, what we've experienced. You know, that's why we're here, to make changes. If the Fish and Game makes a proposal, and it usually is a good proposal, but we'd like to tweak it a little bit, that's the purpose of our committee. That's why I'm exercising that right. And why I'm kind of leaning towards going to a sportsman's wildlife. That's the purpose of this committee here, is to look at these proposals. If we'd like to do it, make a change, that's what we're here for.
Any other discussion by the RAC?
Robert? I'm just looking at the Henry, as far as the deer herd goes, it looks like they're about 200 head short in the Henry Mountains. For what this shows, that I guess it tells me maybe we shouldn't be adding more tags.
Rod had a comment.
Yeah, I just had a comment, but I think the SFW proposals are really quite in line. I had several friends of Duke Ponce gone up this year, and they were really disappointed in the quality of the deer they saw. So I just feel there is not a need for an increase on the permits on those two units, on the Henrys and the Fox Gun, from the hunter response that I know of.
Any other discussion? Call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion that's on the table?
Aye. Hold your hands up.
I have six.
Thank you.
How many we got?
Seven. 98%.
Okay, all opposed.
You can't vote.
You can't vote. Yeah, that's right. Which is why they make me a chair.
All right. Okay. 7-3. Okay. Antlers, Scott McFarland.
Sorry, what we had was the Bucks Bulls once in a lifetime, and then this is the Antlerless. And then Scott will be CWMU if that's okay.
Yeah.
Let's
just
skip
it.
Okay. Okay, moving forward tonight, I'm going to present the antler list recommendations for the 2014 hunt. Again, we'll start out with deer. I showed this graph in the last one, and the thing I really want you to focus on is the last 5 years, from 2009 to 2013, where our fawn production has been steady statewide, in between 61 and 65%. But with fawn production, and we kind of got into this discussion a little bit with the Bucks Bulls stuff, fawn production is really only half the story. The other half is survival. And this is something that our agency is really proud of, and it's a piece of data that I think we need to do a better job of sharing, and that is survival rates of these adults and fawns. So what we've done statewide since early 2010, winter 2009 actually, we've caught and radio collared hundreds of adults and fawns in select areas throughout the state, and so that way we can tell the whole story, what's being produced and then what is actually surviving, and then we can get a better feel at population growth rates, whether they're increasing or decreasing. And so for adults over the last 4 years, we varied between 86 and 84% survival, which is right in line with other states, maybe a little bit higher. And then fawn survival has been interesting. In 2010 and 2011, just over half of our fawns that were that we radio collared in November were surviving to the next November. But the last 2 years, those numbers have been closer to 80%. And so what you get with that is some pretty good population growth. This graph here shows that we're just under 333,000 deer statewide, which is 17,000 deer short of our statewide target of 350,000. And we've had our peaks and our valleys, but I really think that with looking at the survival data, we'll have a much better indication of how we're doing with our deer herds moving forward. So with that background, I'd like to get into our antlerless deer permits. This year we're recommending an increase from 305 to 410. The bulk of that increase is occurring on the Monroe, on an area called the Sevier Valley that just has a lot of high depredating deer and causing some real problems, and so we'd like to get a handle on those. But other than that, no new hunts, no boundary changes. Deer are pretty straightforward this year, antlerless deer. For elk, our statewide population, this year relative to last year, we grew about 1,700 elk. We're currently just over 81,000, and our statewide objective is just under 71,000. So we're about 10,000 elk over objective at the statewide level. This graph is kind of gives an idea of where we're over within the state. As you can see, the northern region, that's where the bulk of our overabundance of elk is occurring. And there's some real challenges there with private lands and different things like that, where it's been a challenge to get public hunters into some of these areas to keep elk at their objectives. Northeast region, about 2,000 elk over objective for the entire region. Again, some similar issues, some tribal issues where elk are harboring on areas that are inaccessible for harvest, and then they come back out post-season, different things like that. The rest of the state is about where they need to be. So what are we doing with permits this year? What are we recommending? We're recommending 16,715, which is a decrease of just over 1,000 permits from last year. And I want to explain this graph a little bit, because when you first look at it, you say, okay, we grew 1,000 elk, but we're cutting permits. One thing that the wildlife managers did a very good job of this last year was looking at hunts that had very low success rates. We had some hunts that we were issuing a bunch of tags in, and they were the harvest rates and the hunter success was in the single digits. And so what these biologists and managers have done is they've done a better job of removing hunts like that and either adding tags to existing hunts that were more successful or extending seasons and boundaries to increase those success rates. Another thing that the wildlife managers have committed to throughout the region is to be more aggressive with depredation and mitigation permits. It seems like in some areas of the state, we're growing elk on private lands, but because we have an objective, we're actually losing them on public lands. And so if we can kill more on private, we can actually grow more on public. And so that's another management strategy that we're employing that really doesn't show up in draw permit numbers. Another thing that we've done for several years now in the state is offered antlerless elk control permits, and this is growing in popularity. It's an effective tool for us, and it also isn't representative in that last graph where it looks like we're cutting permits, but we're actually providing more opportunity to harvest elk. What this is if you have an antlered big game permit. So if you have a buck tag or a bull tag, you can go purchase an antlerless elk control permit at a discounted rate, and you can harvest that elk during your buck or bull season. With the same weapon type and in the same boundary. And so we have three units in the state where the objective is zero: on the Henry Mountains, the North Santa Fe, and then portions of the San Juan and Ebola unit, where we've had this program for a really long time. It's been really successful. It's been helpful. It's helped a lot. And then the other nine units has been the 9 Mile Range Creek, East Canyon, Chalk Creek, Morgan South Ridge, South Slope Yellowstone, Wasatch Current Creek, Aviniquin, the Ogden would be a new unit coming on this year, and then Wasatch West as well. For new hunts and boundary changes, I've broken these up a little different this year. I want to focus on new hunts that already had existing boundaries. So take the South Slope Yellowstone, for instance. It's a hunt that already exists. We're just adding a later season to it, one more hunt, a chance to get hunters in there and harvest some of those elk. And we're also doing that on the North Slope, West Daggett, Mount Dutton, and the South Manti. Next, we have hunts that just require a simple boundary change or a name change. So Fair and Lower and Gordon Creek Price Canyon, we're extending the boundaries on those areas. With an open winter like we had, a lot of the elk were staying high and just outside of the range of where hunters could go to harvest some of these animals. And so if we have another dry winter, we want to keep that boundary expanded so these hunters can harvest. Wasatch 17 B and C, the Aviniquin and Current Creek, we're recommending a change in that boundary. Currently, the antlerless elk control boundary doesn't match the deer boundary. And a lot of the feedback we got from hunters this year is they love the program, they love that we did this, but they said, if I have my deer permit, I want to be able to hunt my elk anywhere in the unit without being worried about this other boundary. So we want alignment there. And then a simple name change on the South Slope, Bonanza Vernal. It used to be Vernal Blue Mountain. Next, we have new hunts. These are hunts that we had to create and boundary changes that required new maps. So this would be the Beaver Valley and the Kishurum Valley. This is hunts aimed at targeting depredating elk. Monroe, Mount Dutton, and Plateau. This is a way to keep pressure on elk as they move between these units. Have a tendency to ping-pong these elk where you have a hunt on one, so they just run across the road to the other unit, and then they have a hunt there, and they just run back, and hunters get frustrated. Chalk Creek, we've combined a bunch of hunts into one unit, Ogden, increasing some hunting opportunity there, and then the Plateau, Fish Lake, Thousand Lakes. For doe pronghorn, recommending a pretty good decrease in permits on from 962 to 669. Most of that's in the northern region. With some of their pronghorn flights not where they want them to be, so they're backing off on permits. And then antlerless moose, we're not recommending any antlerless permits again for this year because of low survival rates on these populations. For doe pronghorn, if you remember last November, we made some boundary changes to some of the buck hunts throughout the state, the Plateau, the Cache Morgan, South Ridge. Some of that. These will simply match those boundaries so the buck and doe hunts are the same. The Mount Dutton and Ponsagunt, Johns Valley hunt's a little different. It's a little different than the buck one, but it's set up to preserve some pronghorn in Johns Valley. And that's all I have for now, Liz.
Questions from Rick? Question?
Just so that I understand, the elk numbers are higher than the target. We're decreasing the tag numbers, but you feel that they're going in an area where there'd be more success and possibly more elk killed. Was that what you said?
Yeah, it warrants some explaining, because when you first look at it, you say, we grew elk, but we're cutting permits. And what we're trying to do with that is say, let's get away with all these paper elk, these permits that we're not really harvesting anything, do away with those, and start looking at our hunts that have high success rates and adding more permits into those, and then increasing our mitigation permits to animals that are causing depredation problems. And then the antlerless control permits, those don't show up as draw permits, but that's a program that's getting more and more popular, and we've been able to harvest elk in the right areas with that. And the thing I didn't talk about with that is one of the problems with antlerless elk hunts is if you stack, I forget, is it Mitch? Is that your name?
Mr.
Happy.
I'm making sure everyone can see it, Mr. Happy.
He alluded to it earlier, where if you just stack hunters on top of each other, you can kill less animals, and they're frustrated. And so this was a way just to be smarter with our permits and think outside of the box to try to target some of these areas. But it does warrant an explanation.
We agreed on something?
Holy crap. Collecting an audience.
Can you go back a few slides? Yes. On those that obtain permit, and then you're going to allow them to hunt an antler?
Correct, yeah.
Go back to that slide.
Is this it?
No, I don't think so. I don't remember where it was.
Yeah. That was
think that was it.
Very first bullet.
Okay. Offering antlers with health control permits to hunters who have any antlers. What about youth in that category, rather than giving them to some hunter who already has a tag, maybe a family member of a tagged hunter or somebody to get a little more interest in hunting? Has that been looked at? Does that work?
As an agency, yes, we have looked at that. And if you remember, 4 or 5 months ago when we came through, we proposed the mentoring hunting bill that we discussed to get at that very thing. So that way, if a dad wants to give a permit to his son or share that permit, that I think that's the avenue we're taking. And what you're talking about is really a concern. How do we get more youth involved? Right. And so I think that's the step we took with that, as opposed to saying if you have a buck permit, your son can have an antler list tag. So this
is an antler list tag that somebody who's already permitted, and we're not going to spread the wealth around a little bit, even in a family member.
You know, I'm not as familiar as I should be with that mentoring program, but I know if there are permits, they have the ability to be shared. But you know,
these permits would be allowed under the law, the new law. They would be able to share these permits, and this is in addition to their buck or bull permit.
That was my question.
This is in addition.
Yeah.
These will be allowed for that.
They would be able to do any big game permit would be permitted with that new law. They would be able to let their kid hunt it or their nephew, you know, grandson or whatever they want to do that way.
I just took this that they were going to get that tag and.
Well, they are.
Sure that that's right. Fell into that mentoring program.
That's
the intent, right?
It does. This is the idea of this.
Yeah.
Okay. This increases antlerless harvest dramatically during the regular season hunts, too, is what it does. Let's us hunt them early rather than have to wait till January to hunt cows, that kind of thing, too. This is a big step that way. Last year, we sold 2,300-something tags of these. So it's a significant addition to what you were seeing the cut. And then by adding more units, you're going to see that increase even more this year from dramatically. So it makes up for some of that drop it prevents as well.
And the beauty of it, I mean, the real secret behind this is you don't add to the hunter crowding, because it's not like you're piling more hunters on top of other hunters. And one of the other parts of this that probably, I don't know how much in the weeds we want to get, but you might actually save bulls and bucks with this, because if you have a spike permit and you kill a cow instead, you have the opportunity to save that spike that would have been harvested. So, I mean, there's a lot of added benefits to this program.
Why do you want to save the spike?
Way to go, Shannon.
Well played.
Any questions? Any questions from the public? Any discussion by the RAG? Comments from the public? Any further discussion by the RAG? Any other questions by the RAG?
I had just a couple of quick questions here, maybe Shannon could expand. One of your first slides, I think you talked about the collaring project and the survival rates. What do you attribute those increase, especially like in fawns? What do you attribute that to? You talked about the collaring project, but is that just the winters? Is that?
I think that's been
habitat.
I think that's been a big part of it, because the fawns, if you're going to have any type of die off, the off generally those animals from 0 to 1 year old are the most susceptible to. They have the lower survival rates in most big game populations, and so what you'll have is if you have an open winter like we've had the last 2 years, where temperatures haven't been too crazy, snow depths haven't been too bad, then the fat reserves, the limited fat reserves that they put on in the summer and fall, carried them through to that first year. And so I think that's a big chunk of it. And then another part is, like we were talking about earlier with our habitat project, a lot of the biologists are seeing these collared animals use those habitat treatments, which has been good. Not all of them, and it's not scientific or anything, but I think, you know, those projects that we've been doing probably attributing.
And kind of a follow-up to that is, what's going on with moose in the state? I mean, you talked about that's pretty flat and just 0, 0, 0 the last 3 years. You said there's been a real low survival rate. What's going on with moose?
We've radio collared. How many did we do, Randall, statewide? There's over 100, wasn't it? 120. And mostly adults, if I remember. Or was it all adults?
All adults.
Adult count.
Okay. And our survival rates were like in the high 70s, if I remember right, low 80s, which is pretty low. And so we've just seen a constant, it's just kind of been a slow decline in moose survival rates. And it's so hard to attribute what it could be, but the thinking right now, and the results are pretty preliminary, but they're thinking they're having some habitat restrictions as well. With some, I don't know, Scott, you've been around moose a long time. Randall, you can answer that better.
Selenium deficiency
or something? Yeah. Well, yeah. The study's kind of showing so far is that there is some issues with selenium deficiency. But we also got some parasite issues. We've got some real problems with some winter tick breakouts. Some of these moose that we've been following with the collars, they literally, you go to their beds where you got them up in the snow and it's just covered in red from the blood from the ticks. They'll be covered in thousands of ticks, not just a few, but thousands. And then we've also found Eleophora schneideri, which is a pinworm, an arterial worm that clogs up the carotid artery where the blood flow goes to the head. It causes blindness once it gets thick enough. Also messes with antler development on the bulls. We know those are there, but a lot of that may be an artifact of the selenium deficiency. Selenium deficiency may make them more prone to suppresses the immune system, and so maybe they're more prone to some of these parasite issues that are out there too. But so they probably all tie together a little bit. But that's the one thing that it looks like so far. It's very preliminary, but that's what we're finding a lot of the causes of individual mortality in the ways those kind of things.
Is there any way to mitigate that at this point?
That's what we're looking into next. The next stage of the study will be the next couple of years. We'll be looking to try to see what type of treatments we can do that will be beneficial. Selenium deficiency gets tough. That's got to be in the vegetation too, some uptake of the soil.
One of the things I've seen several articles this winter is not only Utah that's having that problem, but many of the western states have the problem with the moose. So I don't think we can say it's anything that the guys are doing wrong in Utah, because it is significant for most of the western states to have a little bit of warmth.
I guess my question goes to Randall, but there didn't used to be very many moose in Utah when I was a kid, and then they've done pretty good. Now the survival rate has dropped off, but the habitat hasn't changed that much. Mineral content in the soil hasn't changed that much.
But they could overutilize, some of those core areas where it was higher in selenium, right. The vegetation.
Well, maybe we've overpopulated them or something.
Could have done. We may have exceeded carrying capacity in that way, in some of these local areas. Moose, we are the very far south that moose exist in the country. We are the very edge of the range for moose. If they can make it, we're as far as they make it here. And so we've always had kind of a lower production rate and everything else than some of the farther north areas are.
But they did do pretty good for a while, didn't they?
Relatively good. We're still up there in the peaks of what they've been here. But they didn't even, when the pioneers got here, they don't believe there were moose in the state of Utah. They kind of came in and have increased over the years and have been a little better than they are now, for sure, numbers-wise, especially adults, longer-term, more mature animals, I guess, is what people really want to see engaged by. But we are down some, but not it's not like in half of where it used to be, right, in the statewide area. Down a little bit. We still have more moose than we had 30 years ago in the state.
Okay, any other comments from the audience? Any other discussion by the board? Discussion? Motion?
We'll make a motion that we approve of the division's recommendations on the antler list as they've been set forth.
Randy made a motion and Rod seconded it. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Thank you. Scott McFarland. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Scott McFarland, the Private Lands Public Wildlife Coordinator for the state. And this evening, I will be presenting the 2014 CWMU Buck and Bull. Well, let's see. Nope, we got the wrong one here. hang on a second. I won't be presenting that, by the way. is that?
Scott is the one on this one, any different?
I think they loaded the wrong one on here, so
that's right.
Let's try this one a little.
If you got your jump drive, we can try it on that again.
Give me a second, let me change this. Is it on that one?
It was.
Sorry about that.
If it's on that jump, go ahead and do that one. Because this could take a while to come back up.
Now we have the right one. Sorry about that. I'll be presenting the 2014 CWVU antlerless voucher and permit review and recommendations. The reason they have antlerless vouchers and permits is because they come to the CWMUs as a voucher, goes to the public through a draw as a permit. So that's why that different distinction. Just as a review here, statewide we have 118 CWMUs, but only 63 of those have antlerless permits associated with those, and most of those, with the exception of a few pronghorn and a few deer permits, are coming in the form of antlerless elk permits. But 42 of the CWMUs have their certificate of registration or their CORs are previously approved. They're on a 3-year plan, so those numbers are approved for 3 years unless they're changed. The CWMUs have the opportunity to change on a yearly basis to address fluctuating populations, or for whatever reason they need to adjust those. And 9 of the CWMUs have requested changes to their previously approved numbers. There's also 9 CWMUs that require the Wildlife Board approval for the new 3-year CORs for their antlerless numbers. They were approved for bucks and bulls last fall, last November and December, RAC and board meetings, but then we need to approve the antlerless permits for those. So in summary, the CWMUs in total statewide are requesting 312 vouchers or permits for the private, for the CWMU, and 1,224 permits that would go to the public through the draw, for a total of 1,536 antlerless permits for the CWMU program statewide. A lot of times there's a little bit of confusion on how these permits are allocated to the CWMUs, but the antler and voucher, the permit allocation to the CWMUs is determined by the allocation the CWMU received during the buck and bull process. For example, on the left you have their buck and bull permit options. For deer and elk, if they choose a 90-10 private-public split, 100% of the antlerless permits that are offered for that unit go to the public. If they choose an 85-15 private-public split, 25% would go to the private or to the CWMU, and 75% of the antlerless permits go to the public. An 80-20 would be a 40-60 split, and a 75-25 would be a corresponding 50-50 split for the antlerless tags that are allocated for the unit. On pronghorn and moose also, it's always a 60-40 split. There's no option on that. We don't currently have any moose tag, antlerless moose tags in the state, so I left that off. But on the pronghorn, it's always a 60-40 private-public buck split on there. and the corresponding would be 40-60 per a 40-60 private-public split for the Dell permits on Pronghorn. And that's always the same, it doesn't change. I'm going to go through the recommendations by region, and some of these are renewals. There's one new one, but Mr. Chairman, would you like me to go through all the numbers, or should I just abbreviate this?
I'll abbreviate it.
We've provided the numbers on a separate sheet there, but we have the Grass Valley, Clark Canyon, Grouse Creek, Hart's Gravel, Jacobs Creek, Mountain Top, CWMU, Woodruff Creek South are all renewals or new CWMUs that need to have their approval for their antlerless numbers, and those are the antlerless permits that are recommended. They're all elk antlerless permits in that region. And the DWR recommendation for approval means that we've met with the CWMU operators, and it's a joint agreement between the division and the CWMU on the permit numbers that are recommended here. The Deseret CWMU requested a change to decrease their elk antlerless permits and their Bill Pronghorn permits. We recommend approval of all those for the northern region. The southeast region, we had two renewals that were done last fall, and these are the corresponding permits that are recommended. And the rest of them are changes. All of these are decrease in elk antlerless permits for Emma Park, Preston Nutter Ranch, Conover Jensen, Spring Creek Dodge, and Summit Point CWMUs. We recommend approval of all those also. The southern region, there was just two. Black Point CWMU is a Doe Pronghorn. It's a renewal. There was no change in the previous from the previous numbers that they were recommending. And Alton asked for a slight increase to change theirs for a slight increase in their elk antlerless permits. And we recommend approval of both of those also. Central region, the Heaston and 3C CWMUs requested a decrease in a change in their management plan and decrease in the antlerless elk permits. And we recommend approval of both of those also. So as an overview, we have only 10 recommended doe permits. They're up in the Box Elder County and a CWMU up there. Those are two doe permits, so there'd be a total of 20 permits that go out, but there are 10 two-doe permits. For elk, we are recommending 238 CWMU private permits for antlerless elk, and 1,090 go to the public for the CWMUs for antlerless elk. For pronghorn, recommending 74 private doe permits, and for the CWMUs, and 124 public permits. So as a total, there would be 312 private permits, antlerless permits, and 1,224 public permits that would go out to the public for a draw. That represents just under 80% of all the antlerless permits that are going to the CWMU program are going out as public permits. That's all I have for the CWMU antlerless permit. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm not sure if I ever can give it all to us.
What's that?
Thanks. Questions from the RAC? Questions from the public? Comments from the RAC? Comments from the public? Discussion by the RAC? Call for a motion.
Who seconded it?
James.
Who seconded it?
Joe.
Randy. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Good. Any other things this evening we need to take up as other business or anything else? We need a motion to adjourn. Motion to adjourn by Carrie. Seconded by Andrew.
Anybody's not approved that? Thank you, everybody. Appreciate it.
Boyd.
Hey, Boyd.
What? It's something we should talk about with somebody.